Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of my favorite plans for an interview with a clinical investigator is to ask them to present a few cases from their practices that make important teaching points. That's it, and I just stand back and see what happens. For this issue, I asked Dr. Judd Mull for some cases, and he began by presenting a man with PSA-only relapse.
We saw recently a 59-year-old African-American male who underwent a radical prostatectomy in 2006 and also received short-term androgen deprivation therapy and radiation therapy in 2007 for a biochemical recurrence. He had high-risk disease prior to radical prostatectomy with a Gleason score of 8, modest volume disease, and had one positive margin. Interestingly, he was offered adjuvant radiation therapy but elected to be watched, and so about a year after the surgery, his PSA rose slightly, and then he received salvage radiation therapy with about 6 months of hormonal therapy, and has been in follow-up since that time. And recently now in follow-up, about 2 years after his last treatment, his PSA level has risen to 9.1. And I repeated it this past week, the PSA was 11.3. Now, he's had a bone scan, which is negative. And so the question in this case is, how long do we wait before we pull the trigger for more hormonal therapy in a guy who's asymptomatic with a negative bone scan?
That's a really good question. Also, I guess the issue there is, I guess, not just PSA doubling time, but the actual absolute value of the PSA.
Well, in this particular situation, the other thing that caught me off guard is the fact that he, and I don't know exactly why, but he did not come back for follow-up for about a year. And so, you know, the last time I saw him after his salvage radiation therapy and short-term hormonal therapy, you know, his PSA was less than 0.2, and we were happy. And now he shows up after being lost to follow-up for a year with a PSA of 9.1, and then shortly thereafter it was repeated and it was 11. So I don't know exactly how to calculate his PSA doubling time. He's only had two recent values. I think we can suffice it to say his PSA doubling time is not very good. But this is a clinical case where I'm not sure if we can use PSA doubling time to help us, but by the same token, his overall PSA has shot back up to over 10.
Now, what specific type of endocrine therapy, androgen deprivation, did he get the first time, and how did he tolerate it?
So he got 6 months of complete androgen deprivation therapy with an LHRH agonist and an oral antiandrogen associated with the salvage radiation. So again, good news, bad news. I guess the good news is we treated him aggressively with multimodality therapy and gave him this hormone therapy along with the salvage radiation, hoping it would have an impact. The bad news is we did that really without good evidence-based medicine, because it's not crystal clear when one is delivering salvage radiation therapy, whether one needs to use hormone therapy. We know in the de novo setting, when you give primary radiation therapy, the hormonal therapy is beneficial. Nevertheless, this man got the 6 months of hormones, got the salvage radiation, did well for a year or two, but now has this rapidly rising PSA. He's not too worried about it. I mean, he's asymptomatic. He is not particularly sophisticated. He's not one of these people who's calculating his PSA doubling times on the internet. He's a salt-of-the-earth 59-year-old guy. And the question is, should I just leave him alone, or should I restart the hormonal therapy or do something else?
How did he tolerate the hormonal therapy the first time?
He tolerated it fine. Again, he's a salt-of-the-earth guy, didn't complain much. Basically came in for his follow-up during that time, but now kind of got lost to follow-up and now shows up with this PSA. And the dilemma is, we don't really, again, back to evidence-based medicine, we do not know if we can make him live longer if I give him hormonal therapy now or actually wait till the bone scan or CAT scan turns positive.
Would he be eligible for any studies that you're involved with?
Well, you know, we're like many academic institutions, you know, part of my job description includes offering patients clinical trials, and I'm a big fan of that. But right now, we don't actually have a clinical trial to offer him because he's already had short course hormone therapy, he's already had salvage radiation therapy. So any of the trials that we had, he has some kind of exclusionary criteria because he's had prior hormones. I mean, the simplest thing to do is just say, well, what are you arguing about this for, Mal? Just put him on hormone therapy and be done with it. But I wanted to present this case because if I'm in the ivory tower and put my academic hat on, I really don't know if I'm benefiting him if I put him back on hormonal therapy. And again, even if I put him on hormonal therapy, should I use traditional hormone therapy with an LHRH and an oral antiandrogen? Maybe I could get by with just an oral antiandrogen alone. He's not helping me because he's not a patient who's invested in the answer, and he's leaving it up to me.
So what did you do?
We have not made a decision yet. He is sitting out there, asymptomatic, doing well with a rising PSA, currently in the mid-11s, and I'm going to see him back in a week or two to discuss it further. I mean, ultimately, he'll probably restart hormonal therapy, but I might give him the option of watchful waiting until he becomes symptomatic. And again, that may be reasonable for him. The problem I'm worried about is he's not a very compliant patient. So maybe some people listening in would say I should do an orchiectomy on him. That would certainly solve the compliance issue, although I'm not sure if he'll accept that.
If this man were to ask you this question, how would you answer? The question is, what's the likelihood I'm going to die of prostate cancer?
Well, the likelihood is high that he will die of prostate cancer. He does not have a lot of other comorbidities. And if we look at the Friedland nomogram, the follow-up Hopkins study, which looks at this issue, we do know that, you know, men with a PSA doubling time of less than 9 months are likely to die of prostate cancer, not with prostate cancer, and are more than likely to succumb to the disease sometime in the next decade. Now, for this particular gentleman, my guess is his PSA doubling time is somewhere between 3 and 6 months. And so I would estimate if we just never saw him again and he just lived out his life without any further treatment, he would probably succumb to the disease in about 5 to 7 years. So he's in no immediate danger, but I might be able to change the natural history by starting hormonal therapy, but I may not be able to change the natural history. Another thing on this particular case regarding quality of life, the patient does claim that he has had partial return of erectile function and tells me that he's able to get a partial erection with masturbation, although I asked him to fill out an International Index of Erectile Function score sheet, and he scored it with a very low score of 1. But there's some concern as to whether he is completely literate, which is an issue sometimes we face with lower socioeconomic men. So I'm not even crystal clear where we're at with this patient with regard to sexual function. Now, if I had a crystal clear idea that he truly had sexual function and that was critically important to him, then I might not want to start traditional hormonal therapy because that could clearly impact his sexual function, and I might want to try watchful waiting or peripheral androgen deprivation. Typically, in my practice at least, I mean, rightly or wrongly, the people that seem to migrate to peripheral androgen deprivation, say with bicalutamide monotherapy, tend to be the more sophisticated patients who have read about it, who are interested in that. And it seems to me that some of the patients who don't care or are not very sophisticated just go on the traditional hormonal therapy. Now, again, I don't know if that's a right thing to do, but I just observe that in our practice. I think it would be reasonable in this man. Again, he's demonstrated that he's not very compliant.
Right.
I wonder if he would take the oral medication as we prescribed it. If we gave him an LHRH agonist, we would have confidence that, say, a 3 to 6 month depo would be in his system, irrespective of his compliance. And I don't know, I'm going to explore that with him. The other issue is cost. If we would use bicalutamide at a dose of 150 milligrams, that may not be covered, and there may be more out-of-pocket expense to him. So these are all issues that I'll bring up when we have our follow-up visit, or try to bring up to him.
What's your perception, taking everything into consideration, the research data, clinical experience, et cetera, in terms of the efficacy of anti-androgen monotherapy and also the side effects and toxicity compared to LHRH agonists?
Well, the efficacy is not for a patient who has traditional metastatic prostate cancer with a positive bone scan or obvious metastatic disease on CAT scan. The board answer is that peripheral androgen blockade with Casodex 150 is not as efficacious as LHRH agents or orchiectomy. That was based on some European trials, but the difference was not that great. It was about a median survival difference of about 42 days comparing orchiectomy or LH versus peripheral androgen blockade. So not a big difference, yet a difference, and the board answer would be not as effective. On the other hand, with PSA recurrence or less severe advanced disease, I don't think we know. We do know that oral therapy is probably as effective as LHRH agents out to about 7 years in a patient who has advanced but non-metastatic prostate cancer. And perhaps for many of these men with PSA recurrence, that's good enough. That's a perfectly acceptable therapy.
How about quality of life?
I think quality of life overall is better as long as you do something to avoid the breast growth, gynecomastia, and nipple tenderness. So typically, if you're going to prescribe bicalutamide 150 or even lower dose oral antiandrogens such as finasteride or combination finasteride and flutamide, for example, you need to do prophylactic breast irradiation to avoid the side effect of gynecomastia. And typically what I'll do, and I did it in 2 patients this week, I'll give them the prescription for the oral medication, but I'll also refer them to the radiation oncologist for prophylactic breast irradiation and tell them not to start the medication until they've had the breast irradiation completed.
What do we know about chemotherapy in this situation?
What we know is that it's still considered investigational. There are some clinical trials using chemotherapy plus or minus hormones in the setting of PSA recurrence, but none of those trials are completed. None of those trials have made it as far as phase 3, and we don't know if it's effective. The obvious question that always comes up is, since we know that docetaxel is effective for hormone refractory prostate cancer, why don't we just use it up front and treat PSA recurrence patients with it? But we simply don't know if it's beneficial in that setting.
Any experimental agents or strategies that are being looked at right now and being explored, for example, in the PSA-only setting or even in the advanced metastatic setting, that you think have the possibility of maybe getting to the clinic in the next few years?
Well, the 2 agents that people are talking about are ZD4054, which is an endothelin antagonist class, and that's being studied in a large, you know, global phase 3 program for hormone refractory prostate cancer. And phase 2 trials with that agent suggested about a 7-month survival advantage in hormone refractory. So a lot of people are waiting anxiously for those results. Obviously, a lot of people are talking about abiraterone, which works in the androgen synthesis pathway. And I like to think of that simplistically as a more intense anti-androgen. Basically, it's an oral agent. It's working in the androgen pathway. And again, simplistically thinking like those drugs as a next generation oral anti-androgen. So in the 90s, we had flutamide, bicalutamide, and nalutamide as our pure non-steroidal anti-androgen oral drugs that we used and got very comfortable with. And now perhaps in the next decade, we'll have a series of oral agents that are more potent drugs in the androgen pathway to even lower testosterone levels further and perhaps lower intraprostatic androgen levels lower.
In a way, again, thinking about the breast cancer analogy, I always think about anti-androgens like anti-estrogens like tamoxifen And like abiraterone, to me, it reminds me a little bit of the aromatase inhibitors and getting rid of the ligand. Is that on target?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to think about it. And again, I have to admit, I can't recite the exact biochemistry and molecular mechanisms of that agent, but I think of them as, number one, oral agents working in the androgen pathway and potentially further tools in our toolbox to help care for men with advanced prostate cancer. And these are drugs that the urologist will need to be very comfortable with, as well as the medical oncologist.
Why don't we go into your second case?
The second case is another case of biochemical recurrence, and a 62-year-old man who had a rising PSA and was placed on bicalutamide monotherapy, the dose of 150 milligrams per day, on February 24th, 2008. So he's a gentleman who now comes back after a year's worth of peripheral androgen blockade at the dose of 150 milligrams a day. And he's had a good PSA response. But the question on this case is, what is the best PSA response that we're supposed to get on a peripheral androgen blockade? And the reason I wanted to present this case is urologists obviously have been very familiar with managing PSA recurrence with traditional hormonal therapy, being the LHRH agents alone or LHRH agents plus an oral antiandrogen. And for most cases, those guys get their PSAs down to undetectable. So on the other hand, here's a man who did not want to have the side effects associated with traditional hormone therapy and elected oral therapy alone. He did receive breast irradiation prior to the initiation of bicalutamide. And like I said, he's been on this treatment for a year. His PSA levels have dropped from about a PSA of approximately 6 when he started, now down to a PSA that's been ranging from 0.7 to 1.1 over the last 6 months. And so the question is, are we comfortable with that PSA on peripheral androgen blockade, or are we not comfortable, and should we add anything else in? And basically what I counseled him for, I says, I'm just reading from my note, plan. I counseled the patient that we may want to try Casodex in divided doses at 50 milligrams 3 times a day for approximately 6 to 8 weeks, followed by a repeat PSA done at his local urologist office. The patient was also given a prescription for finasteride to add in should the PSA not drop further on divided doses of Casodex. Now, what I'm doing there is completely off-label and truthfully kind of flying by the seat of my pants, in that it's not crystal clear what a quote-unquote good PSA is on that therapy. And so that's why I wanted to discuss that case.
That's interesting. There must be some data on that, wouldn't there be?
Well, it's hard to get to because, number one, if you look at the early prostate cancer trials, the EPC trials that were done using Casodex 150 or bicalutamide 150, they were done in the adjuvant setting. Right, so they were done typically when men, well, sure, at least the radical patients and the radiation patients had low PSA and they were given that drug for 2 years. In the watchful waiting patients from Scandinavia who had that drug, they did drop their PSA. But the question there that I'm trying to get to for an individual patient is, how low should the limbo stick go as far as PSA? And should I be happy with that PSA? Certainly it's not rising. Or was I justified in what I did? Now, I have no idea if it's, again, when the bicalutamide 150 was used as part of the EPC trial, most of the countries that were involved had that drug approved at a 150 milligram single pill. So they were given that drug once a day. In the United States, where the drug is only available at a 50 milligram dose, you have the option of telling the patient to take those 3 pills at the same time, or you could split it up into a TID dose. And I have no idea if it makes any difference, but I thought I would at least present it or talk about it. And, you know, it's something worth talking about, and maybe someone listening to this will be able to write in or comment on their experiences. Also, should we be adding in the 5-alpha reductase? Did it make sense to add in the finasteride, or should I just been happy with a PSA ranging between 0.7 and 1.1? It probably doesn't make any sense, but in the trenches, when you're taking care of an individual patient, and maybe I'm the only one that's honest enough to say, you know, to talk about these things on this program, but sometimes we do things that we're not crystal clear if they're the right thing. But again, that's part of the art of medicine. And I didn't see any harm. And this is a sophisticated patient. And he was certainly interested. And he said, well, we'll try it for 6 weeks and then get another PSA and just kind of do a experiment or a clinical trial of one to see if it makes any difference in this individual patient.
Yeah, it is a fascinating dilemma. What do you think you're going to do?
Well, I don't know. Like I said, I'm pretty happy right now with his PSA being less than one, and I'm not inclined to, for example, switch him to traditional hormonal therapy unless I have a significant rise in his PSA. My guess is switching it to 3 times a day will probably have negligible impact. My guess is by the next time I see him, he will have started the finasteride prescription, and so then he will be on combined peripheral androgen deprivation with bicalutamide monotherapy at 150 milligrams a day plus finasteride, and we'll see if we get a more robust PSA response with that combined therapy.
Any way to tease out whether adding the finasteride actually has an anti-tumor effect as opposed to an anti-PSA effect?
Well, there is literature in that area. There have been probably now more than a decade old. There were animal studies done, cell line studies and animal studies, suggesting that flutamide plus finasteride were synergistic. And at least there's animal model data suggesting a synergistic effect, not on the PSA, but on the tumor growth. So those animal studies led to actual clinical studies with flutamide plus finasteride that were done and reported years ago. But that drug combination never really became popular because flutamide went generic. In that era, people used traditional hormonal therapy much more commonly, and so that combination never got popular. I will say that we're actually, our group, when I was at Walter Reed, we published a phase 2 trial of both combination finasteride, flutamide for PSA recurrence, and flutamide alone. And this month, the long-term follow-up studies are coming out in BJU International. First author is one of my former fellows, Lionel Banez. And in the clinical series that we had, the patients who got combined flutamide and finasteride did have a better PSA response and longer disease-free interval than the patients who got flutamide alone.
Interesting. Let's talk about your next patient.
The next patient is a completely different story. It's an 82-year-old delightful gentleman who was referred to me from a urologist in the western part of the state. And this patient had brachytherapy in 2001. And at that time, he had intermediate risk prostate cancer and received combined brachytherapy plus external beam radiation therapy. He did extremely well until the last 6 months when he developed hematuria. His PSA has continued to do well, being less than 1.0, and he has not had a PSA recurrence. But when he had the hematuria, the local urologist did a cystoscopy and did bladder biopsies and prostatic urethral biopsies. And the biopsies were all negative, except he had sarcoma in the urethra. And then he was referred to me, and for a second opinion, I did a prostate biopsy on him, which was negative. So there was no prostate cancer and no sarcoma that was found on the prostate biopsy, but we're left with this prostatic urethral biopsy that showed sarcoma. The biopsy was re-reviewed at our institution and confirmed isolated sarcoma of the urethra. So this was 3-4 months ago. I brought him back last week, did another cystoscopy under anesthesia with a TUR biopsy. The bladder was negative. I didn't really see anything obvious, but I did a TUR biopsy. And again, the repeat biopsy also shows further sarcoma. And so the question is what to do. I mean, the man is completely asymptomatic. He is 82, almost 83 years old. in decent health, but kind of frail. He's on Plavix, Lipitor, Flomax, aspirin, Detrol, and has a pacemaker, cardiac disease, and has this isolated urethral sarcoma 8 years after brachytherapy and external beam. And so I wanted to present this one as a management dilemma.
Have sarcomas been seen as a consequence or follow-up from either brachytherapy or external beam?
Anecdotally, people talk about it. This is personally the first case that I've dealt with. And the debate that we have at our institution is whether we should, there's three options that are being contemplated. One is active surveillance because he has no obvious tumor and has had minimal clinical progression, except it was biopsy positive 3 months ago and biopsy positive now with a negative prostate biopsy. The second option is a radical cystoprostatectomy with ileal conduit or a radical cystoprostatectomy with a continent urinary diversion or some kind of catheterizable urinary diversion. Or the other option would be an attempt at a radical prostatectomy alone since his bladder biopsies were negative. We're going to be presenting this case again at an upcoming tumor board at our institution, and I don't have the final answer, but it's the issue of how to handle this in an elderly gentleman 8 years after brachytherapy without evidence of clinical prostate cancer or even biochemical prostate cancer recurrence. He kind of reminds me of my father, very nice elderly man, just a pleasant gentleman. I mean, right now he's clinically doing well. And so, you know, the dictum of first do no harm, I'm really conflicted on this because on one hand, I could do a cystoprostatectomy and ileal conduit, and he might do just fine, but certainly that will affect his life. I mean, he will go from voiding to a situation where he, you know, has to wear an appliance and his urine will drain into a bag on his abdomen to a situation where we put him on active surveillance. And I guess short-term active surveillance is not necessarily a bad thing. He's fairly compliant. But again, I present this case and I suspect that this would cause controversy at most institutions.
Seems like it'd be really tough to pull the trigger and operate on him though, the way he is right now.
Yeah, hopefully I can give you some follow-up maybe on a future program, but
I'm betting you observe them. Okay. Until something happens.
Yeah, that's kind of what my gut feeling is telling me. I mean, the option to offer him a very major operative intervention is something we could do, but I'm worried about, you know, causing more harm than good.
How much do you think the previous radiation would pose a risk in terms of surgery?
Well, in my experience, there's no way to know until you get in there. And I think that's a key teaching point for the urologist listening in, is that I think in the post-radiation setting, resectability has to be based on intraoperative assessment. I'm not a huge expert in salvage surgery, but I've done a number, and sometimes they've gone extremely well with limited scar tissue, limited impact, and other times there's a tremendous desmoplastic reaction, and they can be very difficult. I've been blessed that I've never had an obvious rectal injury in that situation, but other people have, and it's something that patients have to be counseled for. Certainly, if this man were going to have a cystoprostatectomy or a prostatectomy, he would be certainly a person that we would have to do a formal bowel prep and be prepared for a rectal injury or even potentially be prepared for a colostomy if we ran into difficulties and if he wanted to proceed.
Interesting. Let's talk about your other patient.
The last case that I have is the dilemma is how long to watch a rising PSA after prior local therapy. This is somewhat similar to the first case, a 62-year-old man who brings in an outstanding summary of his prostate cancer history, which is typed out and available for review. He's one of these typical engineers who has his PSA on a logarithmic transformation and has everything documented in a 3-ring binder with tabs.
I don't know. I'm not sure if it's where you live with the research triangle there or not, but it seems like half your patients are like this.
Well, I don't know if it's half the patients, but I'm sure everyone listening in at least has a patient or two like this who really documents things. But this gentleman was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma of the prostate in October of 2002. At that time, his initial diagnosis, his PSA level was 11, and the Gleason score was 3 plus 3 equals 6, and he was felt to have clinical stage T2B disease. In January of 2003, he underwent a radical prostatectomy, and he had organ-confined disease, but the disease was felt to be very close to the surgical margins. This was done at an outside institution, and they called the Gleason score 6. He initially had an undetectable PSA in the postoperative period, but between 2003 and 2005, the PSA gradually rose to 0.17 in September of 2005, and at that point, he had a metastatic workup. Now, again, that's still a very low PSA, 0.17, but the outside urologist interpreted that as a biochemical recurrence and did a metastatic workup. He then underwent external beam radiation therapy to the prostate bed as a salvage procedure for this PSA level of 0.17. And the PSA level actually rose to 0.23 after the radiation. So there's a couple of interesting points here that he got radiated for a fairly early PSA recurrence, but the PSA level rose. Now, when the PSA level rose to 0.29 after the radiation, and now we're into 2006, he came to see me for counseling. So just to summarize, we had a guy who had a radical prostatectomy with Gleason 6, essentially what they said was negative margins, but close margins, had an undetectable PSA, but then when the PSA rose to 0.17, they pulled the trigger on radiation, and his PSA really didn't budge. By the time I saw him then, the PSA was 0.3. So that's, you know, the question there. And now we've been following him along, and the PSA has gone from 0.3 in July of 2006 to 1.6 February 10th, 2009. And so the question is, are we doing the right thing by continuing active surveillance? So in summary, we have a guy who had a radical prostatectomy for Gleason 6, equivocal margins, then got salvage radiation therapy for a PSA of 0.17. PSA really wasn't affected too much by the radiation. And now slowly between 2006 and 2009, a three-year period, the PSA has gone from 0.3 to 1.6.
So what are you thinking?
Well, I don't know.
Sounds like he has disease outside the prostate.
Well, yeah, there's a couple key things here. Number one, the outside urologist started radiation even before the AUA definition of recurrence. So the American Urologic Association consensus definition published last year says that a PSA level above 0.2 after radical prostatectomy indicates recurrence. So this urologist saw the rising PSA. It was an ultra-sensitive PSA. When it got to 0.17, he pulled the trigger on radiation. Now, from a purist standpoint, we probably should say that that radiation was given adjuvantly because he had not yet technically recurred. So the radiation was delivered, and during the course of the radiation, the PSA went from 0.17 up to 0.23. So during radiation, he actually recurred and met the AUA definition and has been on watchful waiting ever since that time, where his PSA has gone from 0.23 to 1.6, but it's taken him 3 years to get to that point. So, you know, should we continue? And so what I'm doing is kind of just following him along. And I haven't been pushing for him to go on hormone therapy.
Interesting. I guess these cases really are right out there, are probably typical of the kinds of problems you run into where you really don't have the answers you need.
So I guess, and you asked the question, does this man have systemic prostate cancer? My guess would be probably so. I mean, the guy's had his prostate yanked out, and then he had, what, 7,000 of radiation cranked into his pelvis,
yep.
And he still has a rising PSA. So he must be one of those guys that has occult metastatic disease in his lymph nodes outside the pelvis, or maybe somewhere in some bone somewhere that's smoldering along in this slowly rising PSA. And so now he's clearly in the recurrent state. I mean, no one would argue that a PSA going from 0.3 to 1.6 over 3 years represents residual recurrent prostate cancer, or maybe prostate cancer that was never cured by local therapy, but it still doesn't tell us what to do about it.
Interesting. Anything you want to add to what you said today? Any areas of research going on right now or practice going on right now that you get a lot of questions about?
Well, I think that these cases illustrate that urologists are seeing a lot of patients with biochemical recurrence. There are a lot of unanswered questions about rising PSA. In practice or in academic circles and on these educational programs, we talk about PSA doubling time. We talk about thresholds to initiate therapy. But I think these four cases illustrate that there's still a lot of uncertainties in the field. It still requires the art of medicine along with the science of medicine. And I think urologists, radiation oncologists, and medical oncologists can benefit from a multidisciplinary team in many of these cases. All of these cases have been managed at our Duke Prostate Center. Many of these cases have had the benefit of a urologist along with a medical oncologist and a radiation oncologist weighing in. All four of these cases have been presented at a multidisciplinary tumor board. It doesn't mean that we have the magic answer, but at least we can then articulate to the patients about the different options, make the patient aware of clinical trials that may or may not be available. And I think the other thing is that we're following these patients closely for the most part. Yes, the one gentleman did get lost to follow-up, so that case illustrated the challenges of noncompliance in some of these lower socioeconomic patients. But for the most part, the other three patients are part of the team. They're following their case with us, and we're articulating to them the uncertainties in the field, and I think being better doctors because we're able to have good relationships with a patient, explain the various options to them.